There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
About a month ago, our kids' new school sent us an email and said, good news, there won't be any masks at school this year. The governor has lifted the mask mandate, and we will not need to implement most of the COVID policies this upcoming year. We're excited to get back to normal. And then yesterday, I got an email from our kids' school letting us know that at this time, they've determined that in accordance with the new guidelines from the state, our kids are going to be wearing masks in schools. To be honest, I'm really happy that our kids are going to be wearing masks in schools. I personally am vaccinated. So is my husband. So is our caretaker for our kids. But the news is scary out there. My kids are all under 10. They represent one of the largest groups of the remaining people in the world, in the country, who are unvaccinated, and that is kids under 12. We all want to do what we can, and I know people are wrestling with this news, and it is stressful, and it has been stressful and overwhelming for a really long time. It made me feel good to know that our school was being proactive. And frankly, it made me feel good ordering my kids' masks, knowing that we were doing what we can right now, because that's all we can do. We all want to get back to normal. And this deeply sad realization, I think many of us have had, that normal is still a really long time away. That can be overwhelming. That can be stressful. But all we can do is take the next right step with the information that we have. Hey, Mama. Welcome to the Motherly Podcast, where we have honest conversations about modern motherhood. I am Liz Tennedy, the co-founder of Motherly, and I am a mother of four myself. Today's interview is with professor, economist, mother, and author, Dr. Emily Oster. We had Emily on the podcast about a year ago to talk about her COVID-19 school response dashboard, which was a collection of all the data we had around the impact of COVID on kids at school. And we thought we'd check in with her again this back-to-school season, in part because Emily has a brand new book out called The Family Firm, a data-driven guide to better decision-making in the early school years, and it really helps illuminate some of the really complicated choices we have to make as parents in general when our kids are elementary age, but then also all the decisions we have to make as parents to kids who are going to school in these really challenging and confusing times during COVID. Emily Oster, welcome again to the Motherly Podcast.
Thank you for having me again.
You are like the first guest that we've had on twice, and that's because you are Mother of the Year this year in the middle of all of this. I won't tell your daughter that.
Don't tell her.
But of all people that we wanted to have on twice, certainly you are at the top of the list. You have a new book out called The Family Firm, a data-driven guide to better decision-making in the early school years. And parents have had to make a lot of decisions these days about school, especially during COVID. So we're just really happy to have you on.
Well, I'm excited to be here.
One of the premises of the book is that running a family has some similarities to running a business. I run a family and a business, so that definitely got my attention. And also that we can apply some of these business frameworks that really help run efficient and high-impact organizations, we can apply those to our lives as parents. So how is running a family like running a business?
This analogy sort of stuck with me as my kids got to be older. So my kids are 6 and 10, and I feel like actually a fair amount of what we do in our family is think a lot about logistics. And, you know, we have two jobs and two kids in school, and there's a lot of stuff to organize. And one of the parallels to affirm there is to say that basically we are not approaching those logistics in the most efficient way. That a lot of times we like haven't quite organized how we're doing it. And there's just some low-hanging fruit that like you actually don't have to be the person who remembers the date of summer camp sign up. Your computer can remember that for you. It's not tired. You can just put it in. It can remind you. So there's like some sort of lessons there about that. But I think in some ways the bigger thing that I realized as I wrote the book and thought about this is that when we think about decision-making in our work life, we tend to be deliberate about thinking about our decisions and thinking about whether one decision we make will fit with other decisions, will fit with the mission, will fit with what we're trying to accomplish. And I don't think we do that as deliberately often in our family. We make decisions in a sort of almost in a marginal way, like each individual decision as if its own decision. But actually, they interact with each other. And so, you know, we think of making a decision about playing on a travel sports team as like separate from the decision about whether we should have family dinner. But actually, those may be the same decision, because it may be that if you commit to some particular activity, you can't eat dinner as a family. And that may be okay. But if actually the family dinner was super, super important to you, then you might be unhappy that you had chosen this other activity. And so I think sometimes not recognizing the need for putting all our decisions in the same space is making us less happy than we could be.
As we approach this back to school time, so many of us are reevaluating a lot of different decisions. And it's a good moment to go back into this season of parenthood with a lot of intention. I found the way that you encapsulated this is this idea of having a mission statement, which, you know, most corporations have. You suggest that every family needs a mission statement to kind of keep the big goal in mind, but also to help us make better decisions. Why do you think this mission statement really matters?
The mission statement for me sort of stands in for a bunch of things or for a conversation about what are our key values. And those could be summarized in one line or two lines or, you know, here are the three things that are most important to me. But all of those illustrate the value of getting on the same page about what we're trying to accomplish and that many of our decisions should be influenced by where we're trying to go. But if we haven't agreed on where we're trying to go, I think it is a recipe for a lot of almost unintentional conflict. And we want to think about it, like, if there's something that I really care about, like something which is really central and important to me, and I haven't told you what it is, and you're my partner, then you may well not align with that, even if actually you don't care too much. Even if you'd be happy to align with that, if I didn't tell you it was important, then you're not going to follow through on that. And if we really disagree, then we're going to continually butt heads about these kind of things. When if we said why, if we talked about the ways in which we disagree, it doesn't mean we're going to necessarily agree. But I think that it makes it easier to try to come to compromise. And sometimes those conversations can be easier to have in a moment where we're kind of prepared for the possibility of disagreement rather than a moment in which we are just mad.
So for your family in particular, what does your mission statement look like? And what do you think other families' mission statements could look like?
I actually asked my family, like, what do you think our mission statement is? And my kids said, no papaya. But I guess they were looking for something we all agree on, which is that nobody likes papaya. But in practice, our mission statement is something in the space of like prioritize family time and raise adults. Try to be raising our kids in a way that promotes some independence and, you know, promotes adulting. But I think for me, like even more important than what is exactly that one line is being aligned on practical things, like almost like what do you want Tuesday to look like? So when I talk about people developing like a mission statement, I also talk about as almost as part of that to say, what do you want your day to be? Like, what do you want like a weekend day to look like? What do you ideally want the weekday to look like? What are the big pieces in there? And one example from our family is that most weekends we like there to be a day in which we can just like do something, do whatever. So like on Sundays, the kids have something on Saturday. So on Sundays, basically most of the time the calendar is literally empty. Like there are no things. And then we usually go hiking. And that's because that's what we like to do. But it kind of opens everything up. But having decided that that's important, having talked through the idea that like we're going to do that instead of doing other things, it actually limits the number of things we can do. And we end up doing less than people might because we are trying to keep this space. And something that's a little hard to explain about the book is when you say like my book's about running your family like a firm, I think that people often think of that like, yeah, it's like basically like use spreadsheets to like get more stuff in and to treat your kid like a profit maximizing. Your kid needs a baby briefcase. And I think, in fact, this is sort of like use intentional decision making to do less, or at least try to, if you want a life that has less scheduled stuff, you may need to be intentional. I think there's a recognition in this age of parenting that actually doing less requires planning to do less. And I think that's something that maybe you don't think about with the baby briefcase.
That's a big thing in my house about the baby briefcase because, well, I know you've studied infant sleep. My toddler is taking all of his clothes off at night. And I tried all the typical ways the book suggests to make them stop. But now we're dressing him in a little button-down shirt. He looks like a little businessman at bedtime, so he can't take his pajamas and his diaper off. It's hilarious. So the little baby briefcase, that little baby businessman is on my mind.
You need like a vest. You need like a tuxedo vest. Those things are really hard to get off.
I bought a product. It's on the way to my house. It hasn't gotten here
yet. Is it a straitjacket?
Yes, we needed a baby straitjacket. So the internet provides all. But you know, you just got to do what you got to do sometimes. And I guess one of the ways that you developed to make a decision, you know, I found super helpful. Well, let's say someone, for example, is deciding what kind of childcare is right for their family. You developed this system called the 4 F's to help people make a decision. Can you walk us through what it would look like to make a decision about what kind of childcare is right for you according to that system?
So the first step in this framework is to do what I call frame the question, which is to be explicit about the choices that you have. So I think sometimes people will frame a question like that and say like, well, should I send my kid to daycare or not? Without saying what or not means, with sort of understanding there's a default option, but not actually saying what you would do otherwise. And I think if we haven't said what we do otherwise, it makes it very hard to choose because you're focusing only on the kind of costs and benefits and values of one option without saying, well, what are the other things? So the first question is just try to articulate an actual sort of set of concrete choices, 2, maybe 3 choices that are things that you could reasonably do. The second step of this is what I call fact find, and that has a data piece. So I have some data in the book. There's like data out in the world. Some of it is about, you know, well, what would be right? What does the evidence say is good for kids or less good for kids? But actually, in a lot of these big choices that we make as families, those pieces are not going to be definitive at all. And really what we're going to also need to do is think about all the other stuff that goes along with that. So how do we think this sort of fits in with other things about our family or about our logistics or about our values or whatever it is? So this is a fact find is a catch-all for really get all of the information you need to make this decision in one place. A third step is once you have the information you need, plan to make the decision at a concrete time and then move on. So rather than saying we're going to just make this decision anew every day when every new piece of evidence comes in, we're going to get the evidence. We're not going to think about the decision until we have all the evidence. Then we're going to make the decision. Then we're going to move forward and we're not going to revisit it every 3 days, except then you want the fourth F, which is follow up. Because I think we often make these decisions and then we think they're forever. We commit to sending our kid to daycare or a particular school or whatever it is. And then we're like, okay, that's it. Now we're people who do that. And we would never like revisit a different daycare, a different childcare solution. But as you say, like things evolve. And I think that it is possible that even if this was the right decision before, a different decision might be right next year. Or maybe you made the decision and you did your best job and it was a good decision, but it turned out it didn't work out for some reason. And then you want to make a different decision. And I think that if we haven't planned for that kind of follow-up and acknowledge the possibility of wanting to change our mind, it's very hard to change our mind because there's a sort of almost cognitive dissonance, a psychologist would say, that like, I don't want to have been wrong, so I don't want to think about how I was wrong and I don't want to talk about how I might be wrong. But I think if you've said, well, we're going to talk about it again, then you let yourself off a hook a little bit. So like, we love my kid's school. Like, I love it. It's like the best. I'm totally obsessed with it. It's the greatest school. But every year, we still have a plan to talk about whether we want to re-enroll the kids, even though it's always been a very short conversation. But I want to know that we're going to have that conversation in case something changes.
Well, let's just dive into school decision making. So not only do you provide these decision-making frameworks in your book. But then you also look at the data over a bunch of topics for parents of kids who are age 5 to 12, right? So they're not babies, they're not toddlers, but they're still not quite teenagers. It's these middle years. And that's where I personally am right now with my kids. And there's some big areas that you cover. One of them is school type. Should they go to public school, private school, charter school, homeschool? And of course, we're in a pandemic, so it feels like there's even more options, whether it's remote school or hybrid school. So I guess my question is, what does the data reveal about how parents should weigh these choices, and particularly when so many of them come at real costs and require sacrifice, and whether we're talking about a parent's time or just the financial cost of paying for these things?
You know, one of the most frustrating aspects of this school choice space is if you said, like, what can I get out of the data? There's more or less only one outcome, only one thing that we well measure in the data, which is test scores. And so if you said my goal in life is to optimize my kid's test score, I still wouldn't be able to give you like great evidence, but at least there would be something. But for many people, what we're looking for in the schools that we send our kids to and the experiences they have are something much beyond that, right? So yes, I'd like my kids to learn things and maybe I'd like that to be reflected in tests, but I'd also like them to engage with the diversity of peers and I'd like to contribute to my community and I want them to be nice and whatever are the sets of things we care about, almost none of which are captured in the data. So this is a place where when you got to that kind of fact-finding thing, one piece of it would be to say, okay, let me go into the data. And what you would find is that we have some evidence of sort of better performance in charter schools, again, for test scores relative to district public schools in places where the public school districts are underperforming. The evidence on private schools is more mixed. There isn't as much of it. There are probably some positive effects, but they tend to be fairly small in what we can measure. There's some sort of more consistent evidence on class size. So that's probably the most consistent thing in the data is the idea that smaller class sizes seem to be beneficial. I think that's pretty widely understood, but that's kind of about it. So that's a piece of the decision. And I think a lot of the decision does surround, okay, if we're going to think about private school, what does that mean we would not do? You know, that's expensive. That's going to mean giving up something else. And is also going to surround how good is this school as a fit for my kid? Does it seem like someplace they will thrive? Does it seem like a place they will be happy and they will love to learn or whatever are the things that you care about?
But it's complicated because these decisions can be different for your different kids. Maybe one of your kids has special needs or just needs different kinds of emotional support. Whatever that thing is, you don't just get to make this choice once.
Yeah. And I think it's one of these really hard choices where it's hard to move forward because you never really, like until you're in it, feel like you did it right. It's just hard when we're not sure to kind of pull the trigger. And, you know, eventually you have to, but I think that's hard. And I think it's only gotten harder in the pandemic, you know, people thinking about, should I send my kid to in-person school or not? It's hard to feel good about either side of that decision at the moment.
Let's talk about screen time as well. I found what you wrote to be pretty interesting as a mom of Minecraft obsessed children. We're really big on Minecraft in our house. And screen time policies have definitely evolved over the course of my children's lifetime. Give it to me straight. How bad is screen time? And is there a better kind of screen time?
I think my view based on reading the data stuff about this is that we are too focused on the content of the screen as somehow especially relevant. You know, so people, there's like, oh, is it, like, it's better if you're watching educational television. And, you know, of course, there are things that your kids can be exposed to in screens that are going to bother them, that are going to disturb them. We should be careful about the content our kids consume. And then on the flip side, there are some kinds of screen time, like FaceTiming the grandparents, that I think we shouldn't really count as exactly as screen time. But within the vast morass of Minecraft or the miraculous cartoon show or this other app, or like, is one of these somehow better than the other? There's really nothing in the data that would suggest that. I think the important distinction, the thing I talk a lot about in the book, is the idea that just if your kid is doing something on screens, they're not doing something else. And that's probably the most central organizing principle in thinking about how much screen time should we let them do, is not what are they doing on it, but that it's that instead of something else. And so if you're on the screen for 6 hours a day, then you're not outside, you're not doing your homework, you're not doing whatever. And so there probably is a sort of upper limit. There's an amount that's probably like too much because they should be doing something else. But at the same time, to say that means they should do none is, I think, also not right. And the thing I say in the book is, if your kid told you for an hour before dinner, I want to go sit in my room and stare quietly at the wall with my legs folded, you would be like, wow, my kid's a great meditator. Like, you know, like you would think that was great. And also you get to cook dinner without people groveling on you. And it's not so obvious why that's different from I'm going to play Minecraft for an hour before dinner. So that sort of framing it as that displacement, I think, may help people think about, okay, like, where does this fit in to my day?
I think you could also, in my experience, use the evidence, the data of your own child. I mean, there are certain kinds of screen time, or even if I just give them too much screen time and you take it away, there's these epic meltdowns. And to me, that meltdown is evidence that this is not the right amount of screen time for our children.
No, it's true. And people ask, how do I limit screen time? I think this is a place where just articulating limits up front, whatever you think that they are, can work really well. You know, I teach college students, and one of the great tricks with college students is to tell them that things are on the syllabus and that you can't change them, even though you write the syllabus. So people are like, can I have an extension? You'd be like, the thing is, it says on the syllabus, no extension. I wish I could help, but I can't because of the syllabus. And it's the same. Your kid's like, oh, I'm sorry. Like, unfortunately, the TV time doesn't start till 5:15. I wish it was earlier. I do. I really would. But unfortunately, that's the rule. Can't change it.
Clear boundaries really do help. And you know, another book, I don't know if you've read it. It's called The Explosive Child. I've read that book a couple times. And one of the little tips in there about screen time is that first, you really need to check yourself as the adult with your screen time. The example in the book, it's like, if you were in the middle of doing something on your phone or your computer and someone came up to you and said, time's up, you're done because it's 2 o'clock and you said you'd be done at 2, you're done. But you're like, wait, I'm in the middle of something. I'm typing an email. I'm not done. If someone did that to you, you would be really annoyed. And that insight helped me to realize, okay, yes, I can have screen time limits, but what I do is I allow my kids to finish the episode or finish their game. And then they're done. And at least my kids have a sense of, okay, that was fair. You were respected in that specific instance. And it's really helped in the tension over screen time in our family. So a little screen time tip from our family. Let's talk a little bit about the data around COVID for back to school 2021. It is a really overwhelming time for parents. You just did a deep dive around Delta and what we know about back to school. Tell us, what do we need to know right now?
I think the overarching sort of thing about Delta that we want to have in mind is that it is more contagious. And so it is more contagious than the previous variant. And the result of that is that more people are infected, and that is more adults. And also it means more kids. It does not look like kids are getting sicker than they were before, but there are more of them with COVID. And they make up a larger share of infections, although that is because adults are vaccinated. So that is not because it is relatively more infectious in kids, but just that more adults are vaccinated. So on the one hand, kids are still low risk and still, you know, if your kid gets COVID, it's very, very, very likely in the vast majority of cases that they will have no symptoms or very, very mild symptoms. But we are seeing COVID, particularly in lower vaccination states, at levels that is going to be disruptive for in-person school. And that doesn't have much to do with whether they get infected at school or not, but just that there are going to be a lot of quarantines. There's going to be a lot of teachers and students out. And so I think that's the reality of at least probably the next month or 6 weeks.
For myself, I'm thinking I'm preparing for the quarantine. Like, don't be shocked when it happens. It's not if, it is going to be when.
I agree. I had the same conversation with my husband, like, okay, like when they're out for 2 weeks, like, what are we going to do?
On the note about back to school, I just want to circle back to the book again and the mission statement. Our listeners, you know, we are all hoping to go back to a newer normal, right? We all want to reset our lives with this back to school. Summer is a hard time for families, pandemic or not. So how do you think parents can reset this season of life with intention based on what you've learned and gathered through your book about the family?
I think the main thing I would say is to just take a step back, think about what you were doing before. I think we all have this kind of instinct like, okay, I want to get back to pre-pandemic. I'm going to go back to all the stuff I was doing before. But I think there is a moment to sort of say like, hey, are there pieces of what happened in the pandemic that I want to keep? Are there interactions we had? Are there things I don't want to go back to? And I think that's the frame I would give a lot of people that amidst this sort of desire to go back to normal, to make sure that you're going back to the pieces of normal that you liked and not the pieces of normal that maybe in the moment you were like, I can't believe I agreed to do this. And I think it is a moment for that kind of intentionality.
Absolutely. And it's not just what we were saying as a result of our mission and what we're committing to. It's also what we're saying no to and how you can make peace with saying no. I mean, you talk about how you make a decision and then you kind of move on. But if you're a person who has a lot of grief, right, around these very difficult parenting decisions, I guess, do you have any guidance for that type of parent?
I think for me, this is part of the kind of value of the intentionality is when I am doubting a decision to be able to say, I thought about this before. So I sent my kid to sleepaway camp. And in the first week when your kid is homesick and they're like, oh, I'm so sad, you know, there's like, oh my God, I'm a terrible, I can't believe I messed this up, you know, but then there is actually consciously was like, no, we thought about this. Like maybe it will turn out not to have been the right choice, but it isn't that I messed up. It isn't that I did it wrong. And I think there's that kind of almost a little bit of control or at least a recognition of like, I accepted the uncertainty and now I'm going to have to move through it and I'll have later an opportunity to sort of reevaluate it.
Your career has just exploded. You are super in demand and parents are just, well, I know I talk about you on the playground, you and your work. How have you managed to write a book? You're publishing another book, have a day job, parent your two kids. And how have you managed to just be on during this pandemic when you're in such demand? I think we all have a lot to learn from how you manage that.
So I think my main like personal stress management is running. Like I'm a person who likes to run. I like to run every day. It is important. I like to do it early in the morning. But I will say like I'm getting to the, like I'm feeling the burnout in this. And I think a lot of us, there's this sort of sense that I have, like people thought that summer would be easier. And it's sort of the realization that we have to again do all these things and think about this. And I think that is exhausting for many of us. And it is exhausting for me. It is exhausting for me too.
Well, thank you. I know you have a vacation plan, but thank you for being so honest about what you've been going through. And I know you are not alone.
Yeah, I think I am not alone.
Well, you wear so many hats and do so many things. Thank you for writing this book to help us understand how you see the world and help parents be able to make better decisions ourselves. Emily Oster, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Did you know that you're going to be wearing a mask at school this year? Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
Good.
Why?
I just probably need to take my mask down when I yawn.
Yeah, I'm with you.
But I yawn all the time, so I probably need to take my mask down all the time.
Yeah. Do you remember last year when we had to start wearing masks?
Yeah. That was when we got our puppy, I think.
We also got a quarantine puppy, you're right. We got a puppy and we got masks.
Why don't we need to wear a mask when we, like, smell a puppy?
Deep questions with Mary Galley.
That's it for our show this week. Emily, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your work. And thanks to you for listening to our podcast. As always, we would love it if you spread the word about the Motherly Podcast. If you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts right now, it takes about 30 seconds, maybe less. But leaving a review really helps other people discover our show. And I read all of your feedback and love it and appreciate it. The Motherly Podcast is produced by Jennifer Bassett with editing from Seaplane Armada. Our music is from the Blue Dot Sessions. I'm your host, Liz Tennedy. Thank you so much for listening.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.